And when we talk about justice, we have to, in my view, understand that there is no justice when so few have so much and so many have so little. There is no justice, and I want you to hear this clearly, when the top one-tenth of 1%, not 1%, the top one-tenth of 1%, today in America owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And in your hearts, you will have to determine the morality of that and the justice of that. In my view, there is no justice when here in Virginia and Vermont and all over this country, millions of people are working long hours for abysmally low wages of $7.25 an hour, of $8 an hour, of $9 an hour. Working hard, but unable to bring in enough money to adequately feed their kids. And yet at that same time, 58% of all new income generated is going to the top 1%. You have got to think about the morality of that, the justice of that, and whether or not that is what we want to see in our country.
I concluded my remarks by making reference to Pope Francis and discussing the profound issue of morality within the context of massive levels of wealth and inequality in this country and around the world.
I agree with Pope Francis when he says, and I quote, "The current financial crisis originated in a profound human crisis, the denial of the primacy of the human person." And this is what he writes. "We have created new idols. The worship of the ancient golden calf has returned in a new and ruthless guise, in the idolatry of money. And the dictatorship of an impersonal economy lacking a truly human purpose." End of quote. And the Pope also writes, quote, "There is a need for financial reform along ethical lines that would produce in its turn an economic reform to benefit everyone. Money has to serve, not to rule." End of quote. Now those are pretty profound words, which I hope we will all think about. In the Pope's view, and I agree with him, we are living in a nation and in a world, and the Bible speaks to this issue, in a nation and in a world which worships not love of brothers and sisters, not love of the poor and the sick, but worships the acquisition of money and great wealth. I do not believe that is the country we should be living in. Money and wealth should serve the people. The people should not have to serve money and wealth. Throughout human history, there has been endless discussion. It is part of who we are as human beings, people who think and ask questions. Endless discussion and debate about the meaning of justice and about the meaning of morality. And I know that here at Liberty University, those are the kinds of discussions you have every day, and those are the kinds of discussions you should be having, and the kind of discussions we should be having all over America. I would hope, and I conclude with this thought, I would hope very much that as part of that discussion and part of that learning process, some of you will conclude that if we are honest in striving to be a moral and just society, it is imperative that we have the courage to stand with the poor, to stand with working people, and when necessary, take on very powerful and wealthy people whose greed, in my view, is doing this country enormous harm. Thank you all very much.
After the speech, Dr. Falwell and his family invited Jane and me to lunch. He and his family and staff were very cordial, and we had a pleasant conversation. Did I win any votes at Liberty University or change many opinions? Probably not. Did I give 12,000 young people a perspective they may not have heard before? Yes. Did I open up a few hearts and minds to look at the world a little bit differently? Probably. Was it a good idea to have gone to Liberty University? I think so. In mid-September, my campaign issued a very forceful response to an ugly and dishonest attack that came from the Clinton super PAC run by David Brock, the former right-wing journalist. Brock had attempted to link me to the former Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez. My, quote, crime had been that I worked with former Congressman Joe Kennedy and his nonprofit Citizens Energy Corporation to bring inexpensive Venezuelan heating oil into Vermont to help low-income people get through our cold winter. It was a very sleazy attack. Our response explained to our supporters what the Clinton super PAC had done and raised money off of it. In just 48 hours, as a direct response to that ugly attack, our donors contributed $1.2 million into the campaign with an average contribution of $23. In an email thanking our contributors, I stated, quote, I hope that sends a very clear message that the American people are sick and tired of politics as usual and negative campaigning, end quote. Erin Hill, the executive director of Act Blue, the long-established organization that administered our online fundraising, stated, quote, we've never seen an immediate donor response like what the Sanders campaign received on Tuesday. At one point, it drove 180 contributions through our platform per minute. The point here was not just the money. Our supporters wanted real change in the way politics was done in America, and their actions made it very clear that they were not going to tolerate unfair and unfounded negative attacks from Clinton surrogates or anyone else. As late September approached and we reached the filing period for the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, at the end of the third quarter of 2015, it was time for another leadership team assessment to determine how well we were doing. The answer was, very well. What had once seemed to us an impossible dream now seemed like just maybe a possibility. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps we could pull off the biggest political upset in the modern history of the United States. When we began the campaign in late May, a CNN national poll had Secretary Clinton leading us 60% to 10%. We were behind by 50 points. By late September, a Fox poll had Clinton at 44%, Joe Biden at 18%, and me at 30%. Nationally, we had closed the gap to 14 points, with Biden in the race. In the United States, of course, we don't have national elections. We have elections that are determined state by state, and here we were making real progress as well. In early May, before we had formally announced a Bloomberg poll in New Hampshire had us down 62% to 18%, and poll after poll continued to have us trailing. Then, on August 7th, headlines on the front page of the Boston Herald announced a new poll in New Hampshire. For the first time in the campaign, anywhere, there was a poll showing Bernie Sanders in the lead. Their poll had us leading Clinton 44% to 37%. It turned out this poll was not a fluke. In the coming weeks, other polls also showed us in the lead. Unbelievably, we were now winning in the New Hampshire primary. In Iowa, we were also making good progress. We were not doing as well there as we were in New Hampshire, but we were steadily moving forward. In late May, at the time I announced my candidacy for president, we were trailing Secretary Clinton 57% to 16%. By the end of September, we had cut the gap to 5 points, trailing her 33% to 28%. In terms of excitement and energy, there was no question as to who was in first place. Our rallies all over the country were the largest of any candidates, and our grassroots efforts were truly unbelievable. Almost every day I would read something or hear something about an activity taking place in one part of the country or another, and let me tell you, it wasn't our campaign organizing them. They were occurring spontaneously at the grassroots level. There were marches and musical activities. People were writing music, designing T-shirts and posters, and doing all kinds of incredible artwork. Others were on the phone or knocking on doors in their communities. It was extraordinary, and it was a beautiful thing to behold. You can't run a serious national campaign without serious money, and we were doing that too. In fact, we were rewriting the playbook with regard to campaign finance. Never before in history had a campaign received as many individual campaign contributions as we were receiving. Never. At a time when most campaigns were being supported by super PACs and wealthy individuals, we were raising tens of millions in small individual contributions. In the third quarter of 2015, we shocked the pundits, and I suspect the Clinton campaign, by raising $25 million. This was almost as much as Clinton had raised during that same period. We had now raised individual contributions from 1.3 million people since the beginning of the campaign. Obama did a fantastic job in raising money and small individual contributions in 2008. We were doing even better. And people were noticing in a very significant way the differences between the way our campaign functioned and the way Clinton's worked. Zaid Jilani, on August 10, 2015, wrote in Alternate, under the headline, "Bernie Sanders speaks to 28,000 people in Portland, while Hillary hosts $2,700 a head fundraiser." And this is what she wrote. "Yesterday, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders spoke to 28,000 people in Portland, Oregon, the largest rally of 2016 of any candidate. Sanders hit the usual marks, decrying income inequality, money in politics, climate change, and mass incarceration. What's interesting is that Hillary Clinton also came to Portland last week. But instead of doing a public event, she held a fundraiser at the home of Democratic Party consultants Wynn McCormick and Carol Butler. Access was granted only to donors willing to give the minimum donation of $2,700. The contrast in Portland is a microcosm of the two types of campaigns Sanders and Clinton are running. The former is counting on a grassroots network of hundreds of thousands of people donating small amounts of money and making up the difference with volunteer hours. The latter is a more conventional politician, caught big money donors and flood the airwaves with television commercials to win the election. In 6 months, we'll start to see which succeeds." End of quote. Whether it was the West Coast or the East Coast, the giant rallies continued. In Boston on October 3rd, we drew more than 20,000 enthusiastic supporters to the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center, and there were some 4,000 outside in an overflow area. It was the largest political rally in Boston in years. When I took the stage there, I said, quote, "We are running a people's campaign, and while the millionaires and billionaires have something we don't have, we have something they don't have. Look around this room." End of quote. In early October, after 4 months on the campaign trail, we finally began receiving support from members of Congress. Representatives Raul Grijalva of Arizona and Keith Ellison of Minnesota came on board. They were the first members of Congress to buck the political establishment, and I was very appreciative. For us, this was a very big deal, not just because they were both excellent and well-respected congressmen, but because they were the co-chairs of the House Progressive Caucus. Keith and Raul became great surrogates, and both of them played important roles throughout the campaign. During the course of the campaign, Hillary Clinton attacked me on the issue of gun control. This was an unfair attack, but one that I didn't handle well. It was an attack that also had significant political implications with regard to the rural vote and the general election. In 1988, when I first ran for Congress, I supported a ban on the sale of assault weapons. In a very rural state like Vermont, a state that has virtually no gun control, that was not a particularly popular position, but one that I thought was right. Strongly opposed by gun organizations in the state, I lost that election by 3 percentage points. 2 years later, maintaining my same view, I won the election by 16 points. In 1992, I was fiercely opposed by the gun groups in the state who produced a bumper sticker that said, "Bye-bye, Bernie." They wanted to get rid of me instead of assault weapons. I won that election by a wide margin. As a result of my support over the years for common sense gun safety legislation, I have earned a D-minus rating from the NRA. To suggest, as Clinton did, that I was somehow sympathetic to the gun lobby was absurd. The issue of guns is an extremely volatile one, and one in which I believe, coming from a rural state where guns are very much part of our way of life, I can play a constructive role. But politically, it is a very, very tough and divisive issue with a very real cultural divide, and there is not a simple political solution. The overwhelming majority of Americans are appalled by the level of gun violence in this country, where 300,000 people have died in the last decade as a result of guns. They are especially outraged by the hundreds of mass shootings we have seen in recent years, including the horror that took place at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. The difficulty is that the political divide now is very wide, led by the NRA, which has become more and more irresponsible in recent years. There are those who think they have a constitutional right to have a nuclear launch pad in their backyards. On the other hand, there are many who believe that we should eliminate every gun in America. While most Americans disagree with both of these extreme views, the division over guns is becoming wider and wider and more ugly. On October 5th, 2015, after yet another mass shooting, I issued the following statement. Like the rest of the nation, I am appalled by gun violence in our country and the mass shootings at our churches and colleges. While there is no simple fix, that does not mean we should do nothing. The status quo is not working, and people on both sides of the issue cannot simply continue shouting at each other. Nobody wants more mass killings, and serious people are going to have to engage in serious discussion. In my view, there are very concrete steps we can take to lessen the number of tragedies and to make those that happen less lethal, including ideas supported by a majority of gun owners. We must strengthen and better enforce the instant background check system. We must close the gun show loophole, which allows unlicensed dealers to sell guns to people who otherwise would not be able to get them. We must make straw man purchases a federal crime. We must ban semi-automatic assault weapons, which are designed strictly for killing human beings. We must recognize that our mental health system is seriously broken. While there has been much talk about mental health parity in our healthcare system, we are not even close to achieving it. It's past time for a serious discussion about identifying, intervening, and treating mental illness and ensuring access to care. The debate. As someone who has been interested and involved in politics for most of my adult life, I have, of course, paid attention to presidential debates and have watched many of them. If the truth be told, I can even remember the Kennedy-Nixon debate of 1960. But now, as I watched the CNN commercial advertising the Democratic debate on October 13, 2015 in Las Vegas, I noticed something very strange. That was my picture up there. I was going to be in the debate, and there would be millions of people watching it. It all seemed a bit surreal. As a candidate in a number of elections in Vermont, I had participated in many debates. Sometimes I debated one person, and sometimes I debated as many as seven or eight people. Sometimes the candidates would stand at podiums, and sometimes they'd be seated at a table. Sometimes the debates were on statewide TV, and sometimes they were in schools with almost no media and relatively few people in attendance. I, of course, always, quote, prepared for a debate, which meant that I would spend an hour or so going over what I wanted to say and work on my opening remarks. That, more or less, was my preparation. Sometimes I did very well in debates. Often I did okay. On occasion, as in the first debate when I was running for re-election as mayor, I did poorly. I had been so busy with my job that I almost forgot that I had a debate. Needless to say, what I was getting involved in now was a little bit different from my previous debates in Vermont. I was running for President of the United States, and I was running against Hillary Clinton, who was a very experienced and effective debater. In 2008, she had debated Barack Obama many times and won most of them. In the first debate, I was also up against former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, and former Governor and Senator of Rhode Island Lincoln Chafee. This time, I needed more than an hour to prepare. Obviously, before the debate took place, there were debates about the debate. Who would the moderator be, and who else would be asking questions? How long would the debate be? How long would the opening statements be? Who would stand where? How much time would there be for rebuttal? What topics were going to be discussed? Would it be mostly domestic issues or foreign policies or what? Generally speaking, most of those issues were resolved to everybody's mutual satisfaction. If I had my druthers, I would love to participate in a Lincoln-Douglas-type debate today. The people are entitled to serious answers to serious questions, which can't be done in 30 seconds or a minute. The voters also have the right to know the basic philosophical assumptions and priorities that a candidate holds, which also takes a bit of time to express. Unfortunately, that type of debate is not going to take place in modern American politics and on modern American television. So we do the best we can and prepare for the debates of today. Michaeleen Kroll, Warren Gunnels, Karen Compton, and Edward Chapman joined Tad, Mark, Jane, Jeff, Levy, Dave, and Karina and played active roles in preparing me. Together, led by Tad, they did an excellent job in anticipating what the questions would be. The challenge was that while we had a pretty good idea of the questions that might be asked, we had to be prepared for anything. The range of potential questions dealing with foreign and domestic issues was enormous. For a debate, it wasn't necessary to have extensive knowledge about every issue under the sun, but you did have to know enough to provide a credible answer to anything that was asked. Further, you had to anticipate the kinds of attacks and charges that would be coming from your opponents. How would they try to attack you? How would they try to get you off balance? During the practice sessions, and this wasn't easy, I had to get into the mindset of responding seriously to the attacks coming from Michaeleen, playing Hillary Clinton, when it was really just Michaeleen, who in her day job was my friend and chief of staff. Then, on top of everything that I had to prepare for, the campaign had to make certain that we had an effective spinning operation. That means that during and after the debate, we had to convince the media and the public that, hands down, no matter what I said or did, it was all quite brilliant, always factually correct, and that I was far and away the clear winner. This operation included a sophisticated tweet system that highlighted my extraordinary strengths in the debate and my opponent's unbelievable weaknesses. Needless to say, all the other candidates were thinking about the exact same things. Oh, yes. In addition, my staff reminded me that it would be great if I could mention our website, BernieSanders.com, and make a request for contributions. A debate is an opportunity to raise a lot of campaign contributions. In Nevada, we did the practice runs at the hotel where we were staying outside of Las Vegas. Tad Devine did a brutally good job in playing the moderator and asking me very sharp questions that went after my vulnerabilities. The more we went at it, the more nervous I became. There were some questions to which I was just not responding well. On Tuesday night, October 13th, after going through all kinds of security, getting made up, and becoming increasingly nervous in the green room, I walked out on the stage with the other candidates. The debate began. Perhaps the most memorable moment of the night was a response that I made to a question from Anderson Cooper. When he asked me about Secretary Clinton's email problem, I said, quote, "Let me say something that may not be great politics, but I think the secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. And let me say something about the media as well. I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people. The middle class of this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. Our trade policies have cost us millions of decent jobs. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America." And that's what I said. The answer certainly struck a chord in the audience, which rose in a standing ovation and prolonged applause. Interestingly, but not surprisingly, the media combined the two remarks about the emails and chose to omit coverage about the issues. One of the most fascinating and telling aspects of this debate and those that followed was the answer to the question, who won? And what we learned was that, quote, victory was very much in the eyes of the beholder. People see what they want to see. For a lot of the establishment media and the inside the Beltway pundits, Hillary Clinton won. As usual, she was composed, she was knowledgeable, and most important, she, quote, looked presidential. But there was another world out there that did not look at things quite the way the pundits did. They were less concerned about whether a candidate looked presidential and more concerned about whether or not that candidate was going to take on the big money interests controlling our country and address the issues that impacted their lives. Among those people, I did pretty well. More than 1 hour after the debate ended, we were winning the unscientific online polls overwhelmingly. In a Time magazine poll, 68% of respondents thought I had won. Clinton was in second place at 16%. A U.S. News and World Report online poll had 84% of the people voting for me, and Slate readers had me at 74%. Further, as the online polling indicated, what was becoming increasingly obvious was that there was a very wide generational divide in the electorate. We were winning the younger generation, people under 40, who were learning about us online by very large numbers. Clinton was easily winning the older voters, who got much of their news from mainstream media and knew relatively little about our campaign. Social media was playing a vitally important role. It was not just bringing in millions of small donations. It became the fabric that united the campaign, that brought us together, that shared our message. One example of the power of our social media were the 4,000 debate watch parties we organized on the night of that first debate in homes, union halls, theaters, on college campuses, and at locations in every state in the country. It was an extraordinary event that was unprecedented in any presidential campaign. What we were accomplishing with social media was the ability to go outside of the corporate interpretation of events, bring our supporters together, and communicate directly with millions of people. This was very much the political revolution in action. It was also, to a very significant degree, why we were doing so well with younger people. One of the very serious and ongoing problems that our campaign faced from day one was our inability to effectively connect with seniors. Poll after poll showed us doing extremely well with voters under 40, but we were getting trounced by Clinton among older Americans. At our rallies and town meetings, it was also obvious that relatively few seniors were showing up. Why was this happening? What could we do about it? Campaign staff came up with several explanations as to why this was occurring. First, older Democrats remembered the Clinton years fondly, and Bill and Hillary were popular with them. Hillary was especially popular with older women who very much wanted to see a woman become president. Second, older people who lived through McCarthyism and the evil empire of the old Soviet Union often had negative impressions of the word socialism. To the degree that they heard that I was a socialist, that wasn't helping. The third explanation that we came up with was one that we could do very little about, and one that also hurt John McCain when he ran for president. While younger people had few problems with the fact that I was 74 years old, it appeared that older voters did. Older voters, some of whom had health problems or the general fatigue issues that age can bring, were asking themselves, how can this guy become president, the hardest and most stressful job in the country, at 75 and keep going strong until he completes his first term at 79? The fact that my health and stamina were excellent may not have been enough to convince them that I had the energy for the job. The last obstacle that we had with seniors, which was also not going to be easily resolved, was that many older people did not use social media, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, etc. We were much more effective in getting our message out through social media than through the mainstream media and network news that many seniors got their information from. The poor response we were getting from seniors, for whatever the reasons, was disappointing. I had one of the strongest records in Congress on senior issues. I not only had to help lead the effort in defending Social Security against Republican attacks, but I had introduced legislation expanding benefits. In Vermont, seniors were always part of my core constituency. Somehow, we had to figure out a way to communicate better with senior citizens. While we were preparing for the debate, another major political development was brewing. More and more attention was being paid to the possibility that Joe Biden might jump into the race. Joe Biden is a friend of mine. While we have our differences of opinion, I believe that he has been a very effective vice president and an excellent representative for the administration. As our campaign gained momentum and the Clinton machine sputtered, there was growing speculation that Joe might enter the race. He was talking with union leaders, he was dropping hints about the possibility of running, and there were a growing number of voices urging him to run. The, quote, inevitability, end quote, of Hillary as the Democratic nominee was now in doubt, and there were those who were searching for an alternative to Bernie Sanders. I had mixed feelings about Biden getting into the race. On one hand, what the polls seemed to show was that his candidacy would probably be helpful to us because he would split the more conservative Democratic vote with Clinton. We probably had a better chance to win in a three-way race than a two-way contest. On the other hand, our entire campaign effort was now focused on Clinton, and we would have to go through some major adjustments to figure out how best to deal with a Biden candidacy. On October 21st, Joe ended the speculation. He announced that he would not be running. A few months earlier, he had lost his son, Beau, whom he was very close to, and he felt it best for his family that he not run. I chatted with Joe on the day he made his announcement, and we met soon after. Reaching out to young people was one of the strong components of our campaign. We wanted them involved in politics. We wanted them fighting for a new America. On October 28th, we held a rally at George Mason University in Virginia, which was live-streamed into 250 student meetings in every state in the country. There were about 1,500 students who attended the event on campus. The meeting was notable for a couple of reasons. First, I went into some detail about my views on marijuana. What I said is that if we were serious about dealing with the crisis in criminal justice, we had to completely rethink the so-called war on drugs. Far too many people had their lives harmed by arrests for marijuana possession, and the nature of drug arrests was most certainly tied to race. In 2014 alone, there were 620,000 marijuana possession arrests and those numbers were disproportionately high within the African-American community. Although about the same proportion of blacks and whites used marijuana, a black person was almost 4 times more likely than a white person to get arrested for it. The view that I expressed to the students was that it was absurd that marijuana be listed as a Schedule I drug within the Federal Controlled Substance Act, right next to heroin, a killer drug. I proposed taking marijuana completely out of that act. The decision to legalize marijuana was a state decision, and 4 states had already done that. But regardless of what states did or did not do, possession of marijuana should not be a federal crime. The other part of that evening was a quite emotional discussion that I had with a Muslim student at the university. During the question and answer period, a young woman with a headscarf raised her hand and asked me my views about the Islamophobia that was on the rise because of the racism of Donald Trump and some of his followers. I thought her question was so important that I invited her up to the stage. The International Business Times described the scene, and I quote what they said. At a Wednesday evening town hall, a young Muslim woman, wearing a purple headscarf, asked how the presidential candidate would combat a rising tide of anti-Islam rhetoric in the country. And this is what I said. Let me be very personal, if I might. I'm Jewish. My father's family died in concentration camps, Sanders responded during the speech in front of a couple of hundred people at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Continue, quote, I will do everything that I can to rid this country of the ugly stain of racism that has existed for far too many years, end quote. Sanders invited the questioner, Ramaz Abdelgader, a senior in college who said she wishes to become a human rights attorney, to join him on the stage and gave her a hug as the crowd watched and cheered. Think Progress reported, Abdelgader, the daughter of a Sudanese asylees, expressed concern over recent anti-Muslim rhetoric from other presidential candidates. Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson said last month that he would not support electing a Muslim president, and later added that he would only support a Muslim candidate if they were to denounce Sharia law. Quote, being an American is such a strong part of my identity, but I want to create a change in this society, she said as she asked Sanders her question. I'm so tired of listening to this rhetoric saying I can't be president one day, that I should not be in office. It makes me so angry and upset. This is my country, end quote. Abdelgader told Think Progress after the event that she was pleased with Sanders' answer, adding that she was nearly moved to tears by his gesture. Quote, if there's anyone that should be elected to the White House, it's him, she said. He stands for everybody, whether you're gay or Muslim or black or Christian or Latino. He is for equality. That's why I identify with the next president of the United States, Bernie Sanders. End of quote. Two of the areas that I was considered to be vulnerable on were foreign policy and the fact that I was a democratic socialist. I decided to address both of those issues head-on in a major speech at Georgetown University on November 19th. Hillary Clinton had been Secretary of State for 4 years under President Obama. She had traveled the world, been involved in a number of important foreign policy decisions, and knew many heads of state personally. Therefore, according to the pundits, she was the, quote, expert on foreign policy. I was presumably the novice and ill-prepared in that area. Needless to say, that wasn't my view. While it was obvious that Clinton, as a former Secretary of State, had more hands-on experience in foreign policy than I did, that did not necessarily make her better qualified in that area. In foreign policy, judgment mattered. And on the most important foreign policy issues of our time, my judgment had been better than Hillary Clinton's. I not only voted against the war in Iraq, I helped lead the opposition to what turned out to be the worst foreign policy blunder in American modern history. In my speech at Georgetown, I discussed that war and what I had said on the floor of the House before the vote. And this is what I had said.
I am concerned about the problems of so-called unintended consequences. Who will govern Iraq when Saddam Hussein is removed? And what role will the U.S. play in an ensuing civil war that could develop in that country? Will moderate governments in the region who have large Islamic fundamentalist populations be overthrown and replaced by extremists? Will the bloody conflict between Israel and the Palestinian Authority be exacerbated? And these are just a few of the questions that remain unanswered.
Hillary Clinton, as a U.S. senator from New York, had voted for the war. Further, against a great deal of political pressure, I had voted against the first Gulf War. I was worried about the precedent that it was setting in using military force and believed that economic sanctions could have driven Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. I believed that war was unnecessary. Yes, I was willing to concede that Hillary Clinton had more foreign policy experience than I did. No, I did not believe that her record made her better prepared than me to conduct U.S. foreign and military policy. In terms of the issue of democratic socialism, the main point that I made at Georgetown was that we must establish, quote, economic rights, end quote, in this country. Economic rights. That in a democratic, civilized society, all Americans were entitled to health care, the ability to get a higher education, decent housing, and a decent job at a decent wage. The New York Times got it right when they said, quote, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont aggressively confronted voter concerns about his electability as president on Thursday, making a rare formal address to explain his left-wing ideology of democratic socialism and argue that its principles reflected mainstream American values like fairness and equality. Mr. Sanders, who is hugely popular with liberals but is struggling to attract more voters to his Democratic presidential bid against Hillary Rodham Clinton, made blunt overtures to the party faithful by presenting himself as the heir to the policies and ideals of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Invoking the two men several times, Mr. Sanders said that democratic socialism was reflected in Roosevelt's priorities like Social Security and in Dr. King's call for social and economic justice, contrasting them to socialist-communist caricatures of his thinking put forward by Republicans to tar the Democratic field. Quote, I don't believe government should take over the grocery store down the street or own the means of production, end quote, Mr. Sanders said in an hour-long speech before a friendly audience of college students at Georgetown University in Washington. Quote, but I do believe that the middle class and working families of this country who produce the wealth of this country deserve a decent standard of living and that their incomes should go up, not down. End of quote. In mid-November, a new and very interesting development was occurring. National polls were showing that I, not Hillary Clinton, was the strongest candidate against possible Republican nominees. This completely undercut one of the main arguments made by the Clinton organization, which was that Bernie Sanders was unelectable in a general election and that a vote for me would result in a Republican president. In a Wall Street Journal poll released on November 3rd, I was defeating Trump by 9 points and Marco Rubio by 5. Throughout the campaign, from late November to the end of my campaign, I defeated Trump in 28 out of 30 national polls, almost always by double digits. In almost all of those polls during that period, I was running much stronger against Trump than was Clinton. In early December, a public policy polling poll in New Hampshire showed the same trend. In that battleground state, we were doing an average of 4 points better than Clinton against the leading Republican candidates. Jeff Weaver, my campaign manager, made the point that we were going to make over and over again. He stated, and I quote, the results from New Hampshire, a key general election battleground state, tell us the same thing we've seen in national polls. The fact is that Bernie Sanders is the most electable candidate Democrats could nominate, end of quote. The Clinton campaign may not have liked it. The Democratic establishment may not have liked it, but it was becoming increasingly clear that I was the strongest candidate if Democrats were to retain the White House. On February 1st, the people of Iowa walked into their caucus locations and cast the first votes of the 2016 Democratic presidential nominating process. We lost, but we won. At the end of a very chaotic night, where some delegates were won with a toss of a coin. Clinton received 50% of the vote, and I received 50% of the vote. She received 701 delegates to the state convention, and I received 697. Most of the media correctly perceived the night as a victory for us. From the first day of the campaign, we knew that we would have to do well in the early states to establish credibility and let the world know that we were in this race for the long haul. And that's exactly what we did. With the help of a great team led by Robert Becker and Pete D'Alessandro, we had come a very long way in a few months. As the New York Times reported from Iowa, on Monday night, a disappointed-looking Miss Clinton raised her voice to a near yell as she tried to demonstrate her own conviction. But she offered oddly little direct assuagement to the unsettled working class that still craves her assurance. That task fell instead, as it has throughout the campaign, to Mr. Sanders, Mrs. Clinton's ultra-liberal rival, whose denunciation of greedy plutocrats and an unfair economy are at the center of his message. Given the enormous crisis facing our country, he said here after voting had concluded, it is just too late for establishment politicians and establishment economics. An analysis of the exit polls done by some of the media organizations yielded some remarkable information. We had done unbelievably well among young people. We had done very poorly among the elderly. According to the Washington Post, we had won 84% of the vote among voters 29 or younger and 58% of the vote from those younger than 44. On the other hand, we had won only 26% of the vote of people who were 65 or older. While we lost the women's vote to Clinton, we did respectably well. She won 53% of the women, I won 42%. I won 50% of the men's vote, she got 44%. Also, importantly, I won 69% of the independent vote. During the evening, with caucus results showing him doing very poorly, Martin O'Malley dropped out of the race. I liked O'Malley. He ran a progressive, issue-oriented campaign. It just never caught on. Now, with Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee having already dropped out, we were down to a two-person race, and it was off to New Hampshire, where the primary would take place the following week. Our plane landed at 5 o'clock in the morning, and why not? We held the rally. Damnedest thing I ever saw. But hundreds of New Hampshire and Vermont supporters met us at a parking lot near our hotel in Manchester to welcome us back. At 5 a.m. I couldn't believe it. After commenting that these people were completely out of their minds, I gave a short speech while standing on the back of a pickup truck. We then drove to a hotel and went to sleep. An analysis of the Iowa exit polls, as well as other public polls, told us exactly what we had to do to win in New Hampshire and the other states. As I've said, we were doing phenomenally well with young voters, but these are the people least likely to vote. We were doing terribly with older people, who are the most reliable voters. We were also doing well with independents, people who are not enamored with either political party. Clearly, if we were going to win the nomination, we had to do everything we could to make sure that young people came out to the polls. We had to improve our standing with seniors, and we had to work as hard as we could to win the support of women. We also, when necessary, had to get independents to re-register as Democrats so that they could vote in those states that had closed primaries. While this was not a major issue in New Hampshire, we also knew we were going to have to do much better in introducing ourselves to the African American and Latino communities and making the case as to why they should vote for me. Julia Bonds, the former director of the Vermont Democratic Party, was our state director in New Hampshire. Extremely hardworking, Julia put together an excellent staff and volunteer organization. I had the opportunity to visit a number of our offices around the state and was deeply moved by the commitment and energy of our volunteers. Truly incredible. Our organization in New Hampshire did an extraordinary job and setting up events and bringing people out. It turned out that we brought out four times as many people as we had originally anticipated, 4 times. By the end of the campaign, over 41,000 people had attended our meetings. Incredibly, that meant that 1 out of the 4 voters we needed to win over in New Hampshire had been someone who had actually heard me speak in person. That is what grassroots democracy is all about. One of the fun aspects of the New Hampshire campaign was that my son Levy, who lives in the state, was able to introduce me at a number of our meetings. The thing that got me most nervous during the last week in New Hampshire was that I was in the very unusual position of being the favorite. That made me uncomfortable. All of the recent polls had us in the lead, and some had us winning by as many as 20 points. The Clinton people were letting on that a victory for them would be a single-digit defeat. After a long and hard week, Election Day finally came. We won. It was a blowout. The final tally was 60% to 38%. Watching the results come in on election night in New Hampshire was an unbelievable experience. We had come such a very long way. Hillary Clinton's concession speech was gracious, and she called to congratulate me. My extended family, 4 kids and 7 grandchildren, aren't able to get together all that often. I was very happy, therefore, that along with Jane, all of them were there. Levy and Heather, Karina, Dave and their spouses, Rainey, Mark, Blake and Liza, as well as Sonny, Cole, Riley, Grayson, Ella, Tess and Dylan, along with Nicole and Keegan, were all on hand for what turned out to be a very big night for us. Our holding room for the evening was a gym in the school where we were holding our election night celebration. Before I went upstairs to make the victory statement, the media came in for their photos and video and caught us shooting hoops. I even made a few jump shots. After winning New Hampshire, we began receiving Secret Service protection. Needless to say, it is a life-changing experience. Previously, when I was home, I enjoyed jumping in my small car and running to the grocery store for milk and eggs and whatever. Now I was traveling in an armored vehicle accompanied by a fleet of cars and a number of well-armed agents who made sure I was safe in the bread aisle and every place else that I went on the campaign trail. Over the many months they were with us, we got to know the agents well, liked them very much, and never forgot that they were putting their lives on the line to keep us safe. There was always a car in front of the house and an agent in a booth they had built in the back. They inspected our mail, checked out anyone who came by, and made sure that the house was secure at all times. In a very crazy and dangerous world, Jane and I very much appreciated their protection and their professionalism. We had tied in Iowa and won New Hampshire. Now we were off to South Carolina and Nevada. Very different worlds. As we took a deep breath after the New Hampshire primary and began moving our operation to Nevada for the caucus there on February 20th, we analyzed where we were and what we had to do to keep the momentum going. It was clear to all of us, Jeff, Jane, Phil, Michael, Tad, and the whole team, that one of the major reasons we had done so well in Iowa and New Hampshire was that we had the time to run strong grassroots campaigns that enabled me to meet personally with a significant percentage of the voters in both states. Early on, we made the decision that if we had any chance to win the nomination, we had to do well in the first 2 states, and that meant spending an enormous amount of time in Iowa and New Hampshire. That was our strategy. We carried it out, and by and large, we succeeded. No regrets. In Iowa and New Hampshire, we were able to overcome lack of name recognition and unfamiliarity with my views through a very aggressive grassroots effort. Over a period of 8 months, we held 101 rallies and town meetings in Iowa and brought out over 73,000 people to our events. The Democratic Party in Iowa reported that on election night, over 171,000 people showed up at the caucuses. We received about half that vote. While there were certainly people who came out to more than one event, it appears that I personally had spoken to almost as many people who eventually voted for me. Now that is extraordinary. In New Hampshire, the situation was pretty much the same. We held 68 meetings there and brought out over 41,000 people. On Election Day, I received 151,584 votes. The likelihood is that over 25% of the vote we received came from people who had attended one or more of our meetings and met with me personally. In both Iowa and New Hampshire, we spent a lot of money on paid media. That was important. But to my mind, the major reason we were creating excitement and energy, and the reason we did so well, was that much of our organizational effort was geared to bringing out people to the many, many events we held in every corner of both of those states. Our message was resonating town by town, county by county, as we worked our way through Iowa and New Hampshire. Now, with the Nevada caucus coming on February 20th, followed by the South Carolina primary on February 27th, and 11 states coming up on Super Tuesday, March 1st, we were running out of runway. It was just impossible to spend the time that I would have liked in each of the states and to have the kind of grassroots presence we needed. We had made the decision to focus on Iowa and New Hampshire. It was the right decision. Now, however, we were paying the price for that choice. In every state that would soon be having primaries and caucuses, we had started way, way behind Clinton in the polls and in terms of name recognition. Many of the people in those states still did not know who I was or what I stood for. And now we face 13 state elections in the next 3 weeks. We had a lot of work to do and not much time to do it. The voters in the Democratic caucus in Nevada are the most diverse of any state in the country, including a sizable Latino vote. We were frantically trying to get every vote we could, white, black, and Latino. In terms of statewide politics, Nevada is two worlds, the Las Vegas area and everywhere else. Virtually all of our rallies and meetings were in Las Vegas and Reno, including a beautiful and large outdoor evening rally at the University of Nevada at Reno. As Election Day approached in Nevada, I was feeling more and more confident. The polls had us close to Clinton, and while we had only done 17 events in the state, it was clear to me that I was becoming better known. Further, our staff and volunteer phone callers were finding a lot of support throughout the state. In fact, we had identified more than enough support to win, given the expected voter turnout. On Election Day, I campaigned in the hotels and casinos, urging the workers there to come out and vote. The support seemed pretty good. In the afternoon, we heard about an exit poll that had us slightly in the lead. Winning Nevada was very important for us. It would have extended the momentum that we received from the victory in New Hampshire and showed that we could win states with large non-white populations. But that's not the way it turned out. We did well, but not well enough. We lost Nevada 47.3% to 52.6%. Our post-mortem analysis showed that while we did very well with Latino voters, our overall get-out-the-vote effort had not been as effective as it should have been, and many of our supporters had not come out to caucus. And now it was on to South Carolina for a February 27th primary, followed by Super Tuesday contests in Alabama, Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and Virginia. We were in the midst of the battle. The very first South Carolina poll that I was included in, done by NBC News Marist, had me at 3%, 3%, 62 points behind Secretary Clinton. The next poll had me at 1%, 58 points behind. From day one, we knew that South Carolina would be a very, very tough state for us. We always thought it unlikely that we could win there, but we chose not to write it off. We wanted to make a respectable showing, and we invested a lot of money and staff into trying to make that happen. We failed miserably. Clinton won a landslide victory there, defeating us 73% to 26%. Our outreach efforts to the black community were completely unsuccessful. According to exit polls, Clinton won 90% of the black vote. We were now officially hurting. We had a shot to win in Nevada, and we lost. We thought we could do respectably in South Carolina, and we got decimated there. Now we were heading to some very tough states for us on Super Tuesday six of which were in the South. During this point in the campaign, the disadvantages we faced became very apparent. Clinton was far better known than I was, especially among older black voters. She had run 8 years before, and she had been very active in her husband's two presidential campaigns. She had a strong political organization with experience in the states and had many connections with the Democratic leadership. In the states in which we were now campaigning, we might have the support of a few members of the legislature. She had the entire political establishment. And in state after state, we had to start from scratch in putting together our organization. During the Super Tuesday period, we did what we could. We got on our chartered plane and flew to as many destinations as possible. On February 27th, we did rallies in Austin and Dallas, Texas, and a third rally in Rochester, Minnesota. On February 28th, we were in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and Fort Collins, Colorado. On February 29th, we did events in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Milton, Massachusetts. On March 1st, Super Tuesday, we came home to Vermont to vote and to hold a celebration in the evening. The event in Vermont was beautiful and emotional for Jane and me. Almost 4,000 people came out to say hello. And for a small state like Vermont, that's a lot of people. And we did celebrate. In my own state, where the people knew me best, we won 86% of the vote, and Clinton won 13%, a 73% victory. In the Democratic nominating process, a candidate has to win at least 15% of the vote to get any delegates. Vermont was the only state in the entire primary campaign where one candidate got all of the delegates. We shut Clinton out in Vermont. Needless to say, the results were not quite so good elsewhere. We were defeated very badly in all of the southern states. We did well in Massachusetts, but ended up losing there